Thank you, and thank you to the organizers for the invitation to talk here. So this is a joint work with Ileana Strino, and here's the outline of the presentation. First, I'll review some fundamental notions, essentially from our paper in 2010. Then I'll survey these three silica polymorphs. You do not have to worry too much about the crystallographic or mineralogic description, because I'm going to address only the geometrical properties. So for that purpose, the illustrations I'll provide will be quite enough. And the main part of the talk will be the discussion of the deformation spaces for each of these three types. I have ordered them like that because from the point of view of the equations involved, the gradation is like that. The Cristobalite case will be relatively simple once you put the matter into the proper perspective. The case of quartz is in between, and in fact I will mostly leave it as an exercise, because the tridymite case is sufficiently to, it's more involved and is sufficient to illuminate the quartz case as a much simpler one. So let's start with the review, and since we had previous talks, I will only point out some elements deserving emphasis. So the deformation theory we formulated is valid in arbitrary dimension. Of course, the specific discussion will be for actual crystal structures and in three dimensions. But in arbitrary dimension D, a periodic graph is a pair of a graph and an automorphism subgroup. So I insist it's a pair, because if you take only the graph, the matter is too loose to address. So the automorphism group is part of the structure, an essential part of the structure, and if you change that, matters change possibly quite dramatically. So the emphasis is that gamma is part of the structure. In our case, it's a free abelian group of rank D, and it acts freely. It's the automorphous group which is going to be represented by a lattice of translations incarnating the periodicity of the framework when presented in RD. So a periodic placement is this pair consisting of a placement of the vertices in RD and a faithful representation of the automorphism group by a lattice of translations in RD. So that's a discrete subgroup of rank D. And of course, we must have the compatibility relations. If the abstract automorphism takes a vertex to another vertex, then in the placement, the point corresponding to the first vertex goes to the other one by the corresponding period. Here is an illustration of a periodic graph in dimension 2. So the colors represent equivalent edges under the periods. The periods are depicted here, and this fragment should be imagined as repeated indefinitely with the lattice of periods generated by these two vectors. And in this example, they are not edges. So now, if we have a particular periodic presentation, we may say, well, let's imagine the edges now as being rigid rods, register their length, and we adopt that length as the weight over the corresponding edge. And now we say, well, what are all the other possible periodic placements which induce the given weight? These are called realizations of the framework. Now, obviously, if we take a Euclidean transformation, it's the same framework, essentially, so there's a natural factorization through equivalence under isometry, and the quotient space is now called the configuration space. So a configuration of the framework is just the equivalence class up to isometries. And now this quotient space has a reinduced topology. We have started with a particular framework. We are going to look at the connected component of this framework in the configuration space, and that is the deformation space of the framework, which is the subject of my talk. Now, in our mentioned work, we show that the realization space is a quasi-projective variety. So the quotient space is not nearly as good, but still good enough. It will be a piece of an algebraic variety in some adequate open space. So we can still talk about dimension, about tangent spaces, and so on. And this result tells us that the tetrahedral crystal frameworks, which I'm going to discuss in dimension 3, always have infinitesimal motions, at least a three-dimensional infinitesimal space of flexes. So, but it can be much larger than three, but it's at least three. So one may wonder, given a framework, what is actually the deformation space? That's the topic that I'm going to illustrate with these classical crystal structures. So silicon dioxide is one of the most widespread materials on Earth, and not only that, but it's one of the best studied quartz, in particular, is one of the best studied crystals. These pictures are from the early days of X-ray diffraction, and William Bragg and Reginald Gibbs gave in 1925 the structure of low or alpha and respectively high or beta quartz. These refer to faces which deform one into the other, loosely speaking. So I have to make this cautionary note that the experimental reality is utterly complicated. So the idealized geometrical treatment here means a dramatic simplification of the story. But by and large, this is the picture that if you alpha is the phase at ambient temperature, if you heat quartz sufficiently at high temperature, there is this phase transition, which experimentally is something happens on a rather small interval of temperature variation, and then you get some higher crystallographic symmetry. So when I am going to engage the three polymorphs, I'll speak about this high phase. Each has a low and high phase, and it's important because I'm going to adopt as group gamma the periodicity of the high phase. So that's the group I'm going to adopt, the maximal periodicity of the high phase. Let's see another diagram, which you will see will resonate with my pictures downwards. This is still from 26 and illustrates the fact that these crystal structures can be seen as made of articulated tetrahedra. So a tetrahedron has oxygens at the vertices and the silicon in the center, and will idealize, but this is pretty much within reasonable approximations, pretty much the reality that these tetrahedra are regular tetrahedra. And this is a projection, so you should see the four tetrahedra here not at the same level they are mounting in a helix. And so you can see these pictures very early on. And what's interesting is that in the determination of the alpha structure was based on first determining the high structure of quartz, and then precisely through the hypothesis that the low structure is a deformation, this low structure was identified. But as a side comment, you can still find in the crystallographic literature the question, well, what is alpha quartz? And you have, you know, 50 experiments, and they are not alike. So idealization here is what takes us from the diversity of the experimental world into geometry. Here's yet another picture from the paper of Gibbs. It gives you a sense of the local arrangement of the oxygens in the three polymorphs. And let's just observe that this would be in cristobalite, you have the triangle on top twisted with respect to the base. In tridymite, it's like the base, so that's a distinction you may observe in slides down the road. So let's go on to the case of cristobalite. This is high cristobalite. You want only to think of the tetrahedra. So silicon is absent. We just have the tetrahedra of oxygens. They are in cubic boxes only for you to assist your positioning in space. But you should ignore the cubes. Just see the articulations of tetrahedra. So this is this has the highest crystallographic symmetry, but I will not be concerned in this talk with more than just the translational symmetries of this framework. So I refer to these examples as the aristotype. This highest symmetry framework. Let's see now a picture which represents the structure perhaps less directly to the eye, but for understanding the deformation is the good one. So on the left we have the aristotype, and that's the those three vectors are the generators of the lattice of periodicity. So you see that the Kissing tetrahedra will articulate themselves as in the previous picture. You just, for instance, imagine shifting the picture from S1 to T1. You see that at vertex T1 you'll get the partner, a shifted one, and so on. So every vertex will be satisfied, will have two Kissing tetrahedra at every oxygen. Now, with this understanding of the framework, the deformation is almost trivial, because the length of the edges is preserved. So the fact that the geometrical models are sufficiently meaningful for actual crystallography and phase transitions is that in order to alter the length of this bond, much higher energies are required than just to move the tetrahedra as rigid units with the common vertex as joint. So this is what happens here. To eliminate rigid motions, we may consider the bottom tetrahedron as fixed. So everything is controlled by a rotation at the vertex zero. So we parameterize the deformations by the special orthogonal group and just have to throw away the degenerate situations where the three vectors become dependent. So this examples, which is actually in our paper, in our quoted paper, the deformation space is smooth of dimension 3. Now, one step higher in difficulty will be quartz. So the description of quartz in the same spirit is best done with four generators for the periodicity lattice, but of course the four generators must sustain linear dependence. The linear dependence in this case is that the sum is zero. So to study the deformation space for high quartz, we just have to think of all the possibilities which maintain this linear dependence between the marked vectors. So quickly we may assume the first tetrahedron as pinned, as anchored. So we parameterize the possible motions by two rotations, one with center A1, one with center A0. So we have a six-dimensional parameter space on which we impose the linear dependence condition, which is amounts to three conditions, the three coordinates of a vector being zero. So the naive count is that we have six-dimensional parameter space with three conditions. So indeed, we expect short of singularities, we expect three dimensions. This is in the end the case, so that's why I'm moving to the next example, which is more challenging. So this is a high tridymite, a little deformed, in order to show the relevant generators. So we have now five generators. Again, you can contemplate the picture and see that if you shift with these vectors, then every vertex will be satisfied, will have the kissing of two tetrahedra there. And this a picture repeated with periodicity will give you the framework, the infinite framework. So the two relations which must be preserved for any deformations are written there. Again, the same point of view spares quite a bit of work, reduces the parameters, because we know that the tetrahedra are rigid already, so we can parameterize by three orthogonal transformations now, with center at O, O1, and O2. Yes, because one of the tetrahedra is nailed down, is pinned, so the other three have these parametrizations for their free movements. But these movements are now conditioned by maintaining the linear dependencies. So if we write that in terms of matrices, with a little bit of adjusting to make it more symmetric, we come with a system as presented there. So let me give you a sense of what is the challenge here. We have these three, so to be precise, these are orientation reversing, but this is just a little detail. So these three matrices are orthogonal. And we have to solve that system in three orthogonal matrices. So let's count. An orthogonal matrix is 3 by 3. And you have the orthogonality conditions which are six quadratic equations. So the system there should not be seen as linear. It's not at all linear because the matrices are orthogonal, so it's actually quadratic when so we have nine parameters for each matrix. 9 times 3 is 27, and in this 27 we have six linear conditions, so we come down to 21 affine parameters. But on these 21 affine parameters, you have to impose for each quadratic, for each orthogonal matrix, six conditions, so you have 18 quadratic equations. So I hope the challenge is visible. We have 21 parameters, 18 quadratic equations. What is the zero set? And these are real solutions. So the problem at face value is quite intimidating. What I'm going to present is a simple geometric solution made on based on the spherical four-bar mechanism. And in fact, the solution is in two slides. The point of view I'm going to adopt is that I give myself Q, one of the rotations, and look for how the other two, Q1 and Q2, must be. So, I'm given Q. Therefore, on this unit sphere, I have depicted the first two Cartesian standard vectors, E1 and E2. Between them, it's a geodesic arc of pi over 2, because these as vectors are perpendicular. Now, Q is an orthogonal transformation, so it will take E1 somewhere and E2 somewhere, but between QE1 and QE2 is again an arc of pi over 2. Now, Q is fixed for me. Therefore, the dimensions of, or the length of this four-bar spherical mechanism are prescribed. And now I'm looking for Q1 and Q2, which satisfy the system, and the system was this one. So let's look. These two unit vectors have to have the same sum of these two. Now, it's elementary geometry, spherical geometry, to see that Q1 and Q2 of E1 must be a diameter of that blue circle there. Likewise, Q1 of E2 and Q2 of E2 must be a diameter of the second circle here. In other words, the picture with Q1, Q2 is another configuration of the same quadrilateral. And what's the common between the two configurations is that the length between the two points M1 and M2, the centers of the two circles, is the same. So, here's the geometric answer. I know from the theory of the spherical quadrilateral here that the configuration space is made in a generic position of two loops. Each loop, as I run it, can achieve the prescribed distance between M1 and M2 in two positions. So, in one go, I have There are four solutions. In fact, the matter is even simpler than that. Here you have the four solutions in this picture. There's an obvious solution, yes. You just have Q1EI is EI, and Q2EI is QEI. Another solution is you just switch the labeling from Q1, Q2 to Q2, Q1. And the less obvious solution is that, but still geometrically very easy, you just reflect the original configuration in red in the geodesic arc M1, M2. And you have another solution, Q1, Q2, Q2, Q1. You have your four solutions, end of the story. So the theorem is the following. You have this nice high 3-dimit aristo type. You can think of it as, in fact, this is also the structure of ice. So this framework structure also appears in other materials, not only tridymite. But let's see the result. So I'm looking at the deformation space around this aristo type, and it's going to be singular. The dimension of the tangent space is easy to calculate from the system. You just restrict to you drop the linear, the constant term, restrict to skew symmetric matrices. You see the dimension is 6, so it's going to be singular because now Q is varying in a 3-dimensional domain, and for each Q we have just four solutions. So the presentation, the topological presentation of the deformation space is as a covering space with four sheets, and these sheets all meet at the aristo type. If you switch the labeling, those two sheets meet transversely, but the other two give you some codimension to locus, which can be described precisely because those are the positions of the spherical quadrilateral, which are symmetric with respect to the center axis. So that's the result, and we may revisit the summary of our results. So, with G being the respective periodic framework, in the case of cristobalite, we have n vertex orbits and 12 edge orbits for quartz 618. But in these two cases, the behavior is the nicest possible. The deformation space is 3-dimensional smooth. The 3-dimit, we have just seen the full theorem. The space is singular, can be described as a four-covering of a 3-dimensional domain. So my last slide is with a minuscule, of course, selection of literature in the crystallography and mineralogy references. I want to point out that, in fact, in Pauling, 1930, one sees explicit remarks about the flexibility of the framework of zeolites, which are likewise tetrahedral frameworks. So, in a sense, the story of of deformations of periodic structures is going back, in fact, deeper than 1930. So thank you.